I want you to go back and get your youngest brother, Simeon, and bring him back here. And you'll not, I won't give you any more food unless you bring Simeon to, or the youngest, Benjamin, to me. So they went back and told their dad. Their dad got all upset at him. Why'd you tell him the truth in the first place? Why did you tell him he had a younger brother? And they said, well, it's not our fault. He asked us if our father was okay and if we had a younger brother. So if we want food, we'll have to bring Benjamin back. So we finally said, go ahead and bring Benjamin back. They brought Benjamin back. And then, lo and behold, and the silver goblet thing we went through last time, as where he put a silver goblet in one of their cups, one of their sacks, as they went back into the land of Canaan, and he sent one of his guards after him to nail them purposely, brought him back, and Judah interceded for Benjamin, and then Joseph revealed himself to his brothers. So then he sent. He says, go back and get your dad, and all of you guys can live here in Egypt, and I'll take care of you the rest of your lives, and I forgive you guys for the past. And so in chapter 47, verse 1, and Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brothers, their flocks and their herds, and all that they possess, have come from the land of Canaan, and indeed, they are in the land of Goshen. Now, Goshen, or Goshen, however you want to say it, was the richest part of the Nile Delta. It was the prime part of the land. Joseph said, I'm giving you the best of the land. You can live here. I'll take care of you. I'm giving you the best part of the land for you to raise sheep and cattle and so forth. Now, although this was the prettiest part of Egypt, the Egyptians didn't settle there because shepherds and raising cattle was sort of meagerly work, and the Egyptians hated shepherding. And they hated raising cattle, so nobody ever moved there in this lush place. So it was all reserved there for the Israelites. They came in and moved in. And verse 2, he took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? And they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers. And they said to Pharaoh, we have come to journey in the land, because your servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. And Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, saying, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and brothers dwell in the best of the land, and let them dwell in the land of Goshen. If you know any competent man among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock. Maybe his livestock were herding then, because none of the Egyptians wanted to do it. So he says, well, while you're at it, if you can find someone who's good and who knows his shepherding and knows his livestock, he can be in charge of mine too. And Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And this is interesting. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. The Bible says in Hebrews that the lesser is always blessed by the greater. Just as Abraham and Melchizedek, as Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, and Melchizedek blessed Abraham, and Paul goes on to say in Hebrews that the lesser is always blessed by the greater, here's Jacob. And he comes in before the king, and he pronounces a blessing on him. I want to bless you, king. You'd think it would be the other way around. But it's beautiful that here he is blessing Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how old are you? Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. I'm 130 years old, Pharaoh. This guy is old. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage. He was 130 years old here, and he died 147 years of age, so he spent 17 years in Egypt. Now, before his sons went back again to buy grain, he says, look, you guys, I'm about to kick the bucket. I'm old, and I can't spare you bringing Benjamin out. So he was at the verge of death all this time until he came into Egypt, but he still spent 17 years of his life. Probably that seeing Joseph rekindled a little bit of life in him. Plus, he was well taken care of. He was provided for. He had something to live for, at least monetarily. But he was well taken care of. But at this point, he was at the verge of death, although it must have been a painful 17 years, because later we read that he loses his sight, just as Isaac, his father, lost his sight. So it was probably a painful year, going to be 147 years of age. I imagine it'd be kind of horrible. So he really had one foot in the grave and one foot on a banana peel. He was ready to go. He was slipping. But notice what he says about himself. He doesn't brag to the Pharaoh. As he assesses his life, he goes, hey, few and evil, the days have been evil of my life. He could have bragged about his past. He didn't say, hey, I want to tell you how I tricked my dad getting this birthright and the whole bit, and how I conned Esau out of this. He said, evil have been the days. It hasn't been a good life. In other words, I haven't lived up to the lives my fathers lived up to. He didn't brag. I commend him for that. I think there's been a change after all these years. Tragic enough, it was at the very end of his life that he changed. But nonetheless, God was still working with him, and I believe he eventually did change. It doesn't mean he became perfect, but he did change. And it's a blessing to note that. I hate bragging. And I'm sure the Lord hates bragging too. And I see it so often in Christian circles, bragging. When somebody comes to guest speak so often, we want to introduce to you a great man of God who has done this and who is, you know, learned in this and so on and so forth. Oh, it's nauseating, I think, to the Lord. Earthly bragging. You know how they should be introduced? We want to introduce to you another sinner saved by grace, just like the rest of you. Because that's what we all are, sinners saved by grace. There's nothing special about anyone else. So often we esteem and put people on a pedestal and go, ooh, can I touch you? He didn't brag. Jacob was very honest with the Pharaoh. He said, few and evil have been the days of my pilgrimage, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage. And so he says then in verse 10, so Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh, and Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as the Pharaoh commanded. Now, this is the eastern part of the Nile Delta, same as the land of Goshen, Ramses. Later on, when the children of Israel are in Egypt, 400 years later, they become slaves, and they build, by slave labor, the city of Ramses. They become slaves 400 years later, or 300 and some years later. And then verse 12, and Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with bread, according to the number of their families. Now there was no bread in all of the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in your presence, for the money has failed? And Joseph said, well, give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses, flocks, cattle of herds, for donkeys, and he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. And when that year had ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my lord that our money is gone. My lord also has our herds of livestock, but there is nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. Then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's, and as for the people, he moved them into cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had rations allotted to them by Pharaoh, so they ate rations which Pharaoh gave them, therefore they did not sell their lands. And Joseph said to the people, indeed, I have bought you and your land this day for Pharaoh. Look, here is seed for you, and you will go and sow the land. And it will come to pass in the harvest that you will give one-fifth to Pharaoh. Four-fifths shall be your own, as seed for the field and for your food, for those of your household, and as food for your little ones. So they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over all the land of Egypt to this day that Pharaoh should have one-fifth except for the land of the priests only, which did not become Pharaoh's. Joseph is often criticized for this because they say he was taking advantage of their poverty, making them sell their livestock and even themselves. And the idea with a fifth to Pharaoh and four-fifths for themselves. Actually, I don't see it that way. First of all, he wasn't getting anything for himself. He was doing a job for Pharaoh. He didn't gain anything from it. He was just an agent or being hired by Pharaoh to do this. Second, it was the law of supply and demand. He didn't want to just give them something for nothing. They didn't have any food and they needed it badly. So he set up a sort of taxation thing. They got free seed. They didn't have to pay for the seed. The land belonged to Pharaoh, but they were able to keep four-fifths of all that they got. One-fifth or 20% they had to give to the state. They had to give to Pharaoh. It was a 20% sort of tax across the table. Now, if you figure your yearly income tax and what you pay out and just the stuff you pay at the store, the tax on the dollar, your 4.5 cents or, 7 cents in California, whatever it is, you pay that out. You figure that they didn't get that bad of a deal. I say that because it's just after income tax. And I am amazed at the stuff you pay to the government, and we should, you have to do it. But then, you think that they're getting 20%, and 20% you think would be enough for any government to make it okay. They did fine. And the people were happy. They said, "You saved our lives. Thanks, Joseph." Wasn't a whole lot of complaining. 27, so Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt and in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions, and they grew, and they multiplied exceedingly. They sure did. They came in with 70 people. They left with 2 million. 2 million people they left with 400 years later. They had about a 5% yearly increase, which isn't all that much. It started like around 6 and it got down, but an average of 5%. If you take 70 people or 100 people and increase them at a 5% increase a year, you come out in 200 years with 2 million people. Then after 400 years, that's only 5 children per 100 people per year. So it was a growth rate exponentially, but anyway, they grew and they multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. If any of you might be asking, how in the world could they live 147 years? That's nothing when you look at before the flood and they lived up to 969 years and you say, oh, that's a fable. It's really not a fable. There's been good scientific research on the idea of the land being, or the earth being covered in the antediluvian days before the flood with a shroud, a mist shroud, as God broke up the waters above the earth and in the earth. And there was this shield that protected the earth from ultraviolet rays that promote the aging process. So that... somehow that was funny. So anyway, if you're interested in that, you can get the tapes at the beginning of Genesis. I won't go into it. And 29, or 28, and Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Now if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt. But let me die with my fathers. You shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." And he said, "I will do as you have said." And he said, "Swear to me." And he swore to him, and Israel bowed himself on the head of his bed. So he made him put his hand under his thigh, and it was a common custom of swearing, as you would take your hand and put it under someone's right thigh, which is one of the strong muscles of the body. It was a symbol of strength, of a strong promise. Abraham made Eliezer his servant do this before he sought a wife for Isaac into the land of Haran. It was just a custom in that day. So he's making him do the same thing. And then chapter 48. Now it came to pass, after these things, that Joseph was told, "Indeed, your father is sick." And he took with him two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was old. Or Jacob was told. He was old too. Jacob was old and he was told, "Look, your son Joseph is coming unto you." And Israel has strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me." Luz is another word for Bethel. Remember the God of Bethel when he appeared to Abraham and he appeared to Isaac and then he appeared later on to Jacob. And so he says, "God appeared to me and he told me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a multitude of people, And I will give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession. It's interesting that God appeared to Abraham, and he appeared to Isaac, and he appeared to Jacob, saying that he would promise them a land, the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, for a possession. After that, he really appeared to none of the sons of Jacob. He didn't appear to anyone except Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But here, Jacob is telling him by word of mouth, hey, God promised me and my descendants and my forefathers this land. And then verse 5, and now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. So he claimed Joseph's sons. He said, your kids, by the way, they're mine. Thanks, Dad. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Your offspring who you beget after them shall be yours, and will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. But as for me, when I came from Padan, Rachel died with me, or beside me in the land of Canaan, on the way when there was a little distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, who are these? Now, it was a custom in those days for the firstborn to get a double portion of the inheritance. What Jacob is doing is giving his son Joseph the double portion of the inheritance. He's saying, I'm going to take your kids, I'm going to call them my own kids, and they're going to have the lineage, my own lineage. And these actually became one of the tribes of Israel. Remember the 12 tribes of Israel? Well, actually, there's 13 tribes of Israel, if you want to be technical. Because Joseph has two, there's his sons, there's two half-tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. And they're always listed as 12 tribes, but Joseph has two half-tribes. So a lot of times you see Joseph not listed and Ephraim listed and Manasseh listed, but Joseph is has inheritance because he has the double portion, having two of them, two tribes named after him. Now, when the land was apportioned, later on we get into the book of Joshua, and the land was apportioned under Joshua, there are still only 12 tribes. And there's a couple tribes that aren't named. Levi was not apportioned a parcel of land, because Levi was the priestly line, and the priest lived in 48 different cities scattered, so they had the priestly line throughout all of the other tribes of Israel. They had not really their own apportionment. So Levi didn't have his land, everyone else did, but they lived in 48, 50 other cities that God gave to them. It's a fascinating story, and it wouldn't behoove us to go through it now, but to take a study of all the times the 12 tribes of Israel are listed, because they're put in different orders. And it's especially interesting when you get to the book of Revelation, where you see during the Great Tribulation that there's 144,000 of the tribes of Israel, and he names the 12 tribes, but there's a tribe that is not listed there. And that's the tribe of Dan. Dan is always listed, but when it comes to being sealed through the tribulation period and reigning with God on Mount Zion forever, Dan is not listed. And you figure, well, why isn't Dan listed? Well, Dan settled in the north of Israel, the far north of Israel. There's still the settlement of Dan, Tel Dan today. And it was under Dan that the nation apostatized, fell away, and there in Dan, there's still the remains of pagan altars under Jeroboam. As he said, a pagan altars in the south and in the north, in Judea, and one up in Dan, and it was through the tribe of Dan that the nation actually fell. And so you see Dan not listed as being sealed by God during the tribulation period. It's sort of a fascinating kind of a study. So anyway, there's 12 tribes. And 12 seems to be the number of human governments as you go through the scriptures. For some reason, 12 apostles, 12 tribes in the book of Revelation, 12 cities and gates, the foundations built on the 12 apostles, and so forth. So verse 8, Israel saw Joseph's two sons and said, who are these? And Joseph said to his father, they're my sons, whom God has given me in this place. And he said, bring them to me, and I will bless them. And the eyes of Israel were dim with age. It seemed like there was a lot of problem with not being able to see, not just the older people, but even in the Mideast today, as you go over there, a lot of people have eye problems. It's amazing to see, especially in the Arab culture. Young people, their vision has gone, and they're totally blind or almost all blind. And you can look in their eyes, they look weird, as it seems like the pupils have constricted and or just it's all white inside there. But there's a lot of eye disease. Maybe it's the bright sun, I don't know, but it seems like it's with many of the Mideastern tribes, they can't see after a certain age. So his eyes were dim, and he told him to bring his sons there. And then verse 10, Joseph brought them near to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I had not thought to see your face, but in fact God has also shown me your offspring. So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, bowed down with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near to him. And Ephraim stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. Joseph set his kids in front of Jacob to be blessed. He purposely put Manasseh so that Jacob would put his right hand on Manasseh, who was born first, the firstborn, to receive the inheritance and the blessing. Jacob, by revelation, I guess, put his hand and crossed him and put his right hand on the younger, guiding his hands knowingly. Even though Manasseh was the firstborn, Ephraim gets the blessing of the firstborn passed to him. And he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, and God who has fed me all my life long to this day. What a great phrase. Finally, he realizes that God all along has been his provider. And Jacob says, God who has fed me all my life long to this day. Mark that in your hearts. It's God who takes care of you. God has fed you. Not just your paycheck from Alpha Beta or from the government or whatever. God has fed me up to this day. God has taken care of me in different forms, in different ways. And though that source fail, though that job fail, though the check doesn't come in, God is in charge. Now, you might not always eat like a king, but God will feed you. God will take care of you. God gave them manna in the wilderness, which they looked at it and they said, mana means what is it in Hebrew. So they called it, what is it? Hey, would you please pass some more what is it? A little ketchup, please. That's what it was called. In Hebrew, mana means what is it? They didn't know what it was, but God sustained them. You know, and imagine having the same course every day for years. But God took care of them. They complained, but God took care of them. The God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named among them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now, before we go on and finish out this chapter, I want to bring something up that's very important. You might get tricked on this. If a friendly person in a suit comes to your door with a big smile and Watchtower magazines, and he'll say, Hi, friend, God bless you. Oh, your church must teach you that Jesus is God, huh? Well, let me tell you what the Bible says. The Bible never says Jesus is God. The Bible says Jesus was a created being. But he's not God. There's no deity involved. They look so friendly and so nice. I've had them come to my door before, and they say, well, turn to a scripture with me, and I want you to turn to it. Turn to the book of Colossians chapter 1. In Colossians chapter 1, look at verse 13. It says, He has delivered us from the power of darkness, and He has translated us into the kingdom of His Son and His love, in whom we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God. He's speaking of Jesus all along. He is the image of the invisible God. Notice, the firstborn over all creation. And they said, well, now let me ask you this. If Jesus Christ is the firstborn, how could He be God? He's the firstborn. God created Him, they say, and then Jesus created everything else. Because He's the firstborn. And they turn to another one in Revelation 1 and the end of Revelation. Jesus is the firstborn from among the dead. And so they say, see, Christian, you've been wrong all along. Jesus is the firstborn. He didn't create. He was created. He was born of God. And so I take them back to Genesis chapter 48, where we were, verse 14. Israel stretched his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And so I ask them, who was the firstborn? And they say, obviously Manasseh was the firstborn. I said, remember that. Now turn with me to Jeremiah 31. Turn to Jeremiah 31. God is speaking here of a remnant of Israel saved. And he goes back to the names of Ephraim and Manasseh. But he says in verse 9, "They shall come with weeping, and with supplications I will lead them. I will cause them to walk by the rivers in a straight way, which they shall not stumble. For I am a father to Israel," which is Jacob's name changed, "and Ephraim is my firstborn." So I ask them again, now, who is the firstborn? Well, Manasseh. Well, it just says, who's the firstborn here? Ephraim. So I said, that means there's two firstborns. And they scratch their head and they go, no, it can't be. I said, because you missed a very important point. The word firstborn in Genesis 48 means one born first. The word firstborn in Jeremiah means highest in priority, the most important. Although Ephraim was born second, God placed upon him the right of the firstborn, making him more important. The Greek word firstborn in Colossians means Jesus Christ was the most important, the highest in order. It doesn't mean he was born first. But their beautiful intention of messing up the Greek language with the New World Translation, they've succeeded. And they don't know the language. And so they'll try to con you with all sorts of mistranslations. Be aware of it. Be aware of it. I don't blame it on the people that go door to door. And I don't want to climb down on them. I think they're very sincere, loving people. The people I blame is the people in New York who give them the trash. Give them the literature. Feed them. Pump them up with the stuff. And the poor people door to door, they don't know any better. That's why we need to be a light and lovingly, not to say, see, you're wrong. To show them that Jesus Christ is indeed the highest in order. This proves in Colossians the deity of Jesus Christ. It doesn't discount it. Lovingly show them their error. Bring them to the knowledge of Jesus Christ so that they don't serve another Jesus. So that they realize and give honor. For he that has not the Son, 1 John, has not the Father. And that's tragic. So we need to lovingly show them. So I wanted to bring that out. I digress a little bit, but they'll point that out to you. And then we'll finish up verse 17 of chapter 48. "Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, 'Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head.'" In other words, "Dad, you're doing it all wrong. Manasseh is the firstborn." But he knew what he was doing. Now, it's interesting that Jacob himself, he knew what he was doing, all right. Jacob himself was the one who conned his dad out of the birthright with him and Esau. Although I believe it was God's will for Jacob to have the birthright, he didn't need to help God out and con his dad into it. He would have gotten it one way or the other, probably this way. But nonetheless, he realized that this is God's hand, God's providential hand in this. But his father refused, and he said, "I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." And he blessed them that day, saying, "By you Israel will bless, saying, 'May God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh.' And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Behold, I am dying. But God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you one portion of your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and the bow.'" And then chapter 49, one of the greatest chapters, I think, in the scripture. "Jacob called his sons, and he said, 'Gather together, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days.'" This is the best hour, of Jacob. He's at his prime here. He's taking the role of a prophet. He's prophesying the end and the future of the tribes of Israel individually through the sons. So he starts with the eldest and he goes down. He says, "Okay, Reuben, come here. I want to talk to you a minute." And he prophesies to each one of them, tells them a little bit about, but he says, "Gather together that I might tell you what shall befall you in the last days." This does not refer to the last days of the age that we know, like the rapture of the church, the second coming, the millennial reign and all. It has to do with the last days of the tribes of Israel, the future of the tribes of Israel. And so he says, verse 3, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, the excellency of power." But he says, "You're unstable as water. You shall not excel. Because you went up to your father's bed." You remember that this was the man who went up to Bilhah, the handmaiden, and one of the wives of Jacob, and went in unto her sexually and had the unspeakable sin. And this guy was sort of a very unstable kind of a person. He was the firstborn, but he relinquished his right of the firstborn because of his sin to Joseph, and Joseph received the right of the firstborn. He also relinquished his right to the priesthood, which was eventually, when the priesthood was initiated, the firstborn. It always came from the lineage of the firstborn. But he relinquished that right to Levi. Levi became the priestly line. But he says, verse 4, you're unstable as water. You shall not excel. Literally, the translation would be, you're like water without restraint. He meant well in some cases. He had a lot of plans, but you couldn't rely on the guy. Could never carry him through. There's a lot of personality traits in all of these 12 that fit very many. It's fun to line yourself up with these, see where you fit. Because there's a lot of people who mean well. Yeah, I want to do that. I want to serve. I want to help. But they're unstable as water. You can't count on them to carry it through, to always be there. The commitment isn't there. Unstable as water. Just sort of flows out and, you know, doesn't go anywhere. Unstable. Because you went up to your father's bed. And then he says, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Simeon and Levi, so we get Simeon and Levi, are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitation. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man. And in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And it was true. Simeon became a tribe that was scattered everywhere. And it happened with Levi. Levi never received a portion of his land. His portion was divided to everyone else. And so the prophecy did come true. But notice that their trait, they had a violent temper. They couldn't really control it. And these were the brothers. Remember when their sister was abused by one of the people from Shechem, the Shechemites? He and Levi went up to Shechem and destroyed them all, just killed all of them. Instead of getting the guy who did it, they killed the whole town, all the guys in the town. And Jacob came up to him and said, you have made my reputation to stink in this land because of you guys. They were cruel and they had unrestrained anger. Just an anger that flared up, that wasn't controlled. Let me tell you, anger can be horrible, but let me tell you this, anger can also be controlled by God. A lot of us have anger, but know that God can control that. If He can, He can deliver you from that. I don't mean cast something out of you, I mean God can give you a deliverance. And it takes saying no to your anger, crucifying, mortifying the deeds of the flesh. Sometimes we excuse our flesh. We excuse the manifestations of our flesh when we do something. We say, oh, well, that's just me. Yes, it is you. Get rid of it. Mortify the deeds of the flesh. Don't let that be your excuse. Well, that's just the way I am. I was born that way. We were all born by nature the children of wrath. God wants to make a new you. And so many people just fly off the handle. They give a piece of their mind to everyone. They don't have any left after a while. They give it all away. Always ready to flare up into rage and to get mad, and they blow up. Now, the secret and the success isn't when you can just hold it in. When you can hold the pressure in, the blessing is when there's no more pressure inside. Because anyone can hold it in and go under a train bridge and yell their brains out while the train goes by and get it out or something. But the blessing is when God takes the pressure away and you can just roll it off like Joseph did. Ah, God meant it for the good. No problem. I'm not saying that's easy. There's a long way for all of us to go. But then he says to Judah in verse 8, Judah, you are he whom your brother shall praise. And Judah's name means praise. You shall be on the neck of your enemies, your father's children. You shall bow down before you. Notice verse 9, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh came. Judah had a change of heart. Remember it was Judah who stood over the pit and looked at his brother and said, hey, let's sell him as a slave into Egypt. Let's make some bucks off of him. He had a change of heart because later on he interceded for Benjamin. He said, Father, I will be a surety for him He'll be my responsibility. And then he told Joseph, he says, take me as the slave and let the lad go. He had a change of heart. But notice that he is called a lion, a lion's whelp. That's where the phrase comes in Revelation 5, Jesus being the lion of the tribe of Judah. Because the tribe of Judah is the royal line. King David came from the line of Judah. Jesus Christ is of the lineage of Judah through the royal line of King David. It's the kingly line. Jesus is called the lion of the tribe of Judah in Revelation. So he says, Judah is a lion's whelp. And so, and the beautiful thing is that the lion became the symbol eventually for the tribe of Israel. As you see him going through Exodus and Leviticus, Deuteronomy, they had their banner, and their banner was that of a lion. When Israel camped around the tabernacle, they had four camps, one on each side of the tabernacle, three tribes per camp, and they had a symbol for each of the camps. One symbol was the lion, which took in the tribe of Judah and a few other tribes. The other one was the face of a man. The other one was the face of an ox. And the other one was the face of an eagle. Now, if you are at all interested or have been studying at all some of the New Testament Gospels and the book of Revelation, this should become very alive to you, because some of the faces on the cherubim in Revelation, the first few chapters, are the face of a lion, the face of a man, the face of an ox, an eagle, and so forth. And you compare that with the four Gospels, and you could put one of the banners on each of the four Gospels. For the Gospel of Matthew speaks about Jesus fulfilling all the prophecies of the Old Testament, being the Jewish Messiah. And he, you could put the symbol of the lion over Matthew, fulfilling all the messianic prophecies of the line of Judah. Then you get to the Gospel of Mark. Jesus Christ is seen as being a servant. I come among you as one who serves. And we come to the other symbol, the ox, which is the animal of serving. Then you get to the book of Luke. Jesus Christ is seen as the Son of Man. He calls himself the Son of Man is the recurrent phrase. The other symbol, the sign of a man. And then you get to the book of John, where Jesus Christ is seen in his deity, being God. And you could put the eagle over that one. They all match the four camps. And then the book of Revelation, the four faces, and the book of Ezekiel, chapter 1 and 10, with the cherubim and the four faces and all. It's a fascinating study, if you're into that. But notice here in verse 10, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time, but this is so fascinating. Verse 10, the scepter, or the kingship, the scepter shall not depart from Judah until, or nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. The word Shiloh means the one to whom it belongs. He says, the scepter shall not depart from the tribe of Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, till the one to whom it belongs comes. The Jews, for thousands of years, have always seen this as a reference to the Messiah. So much so that there was a procession around Jerusalem when the rite of capital punishment and the rite of the law was taken away from the Sanhedrin, the Jewish people, and given to the Roman government. All the priests had a procession around Jerusalem in sackcloth and ashes, bewailing the fact that God had forsaken his promise to Israel. And this is the scripture they said. They said, God said that the scepter will not depart from Judah until Shiloh, the Messiah, has come. And he hasn't come. And the scepter has been taken away. Little did they know, at the very same time they spoke that, there was a man leaving a carpenter shop in Nazareth. His name was Jesus. Heading on his way down to Jerusalem to fulfill all of the prophecies at the exact same time that all this was going on. When the scepter departed from Judah, Jesus Christ entered his three-year public ministry. Amazing! To the one to whom it belongs. 70 years later, Titus of the Roman legions came and destroyed Jerusalem, leveled the temple, so that the Messiah would have to have come before the 70 AD, because the temple was destroyed. Judah was no longer around. They were deported. They were taken away. So the Messiah had to come, according to the prophecies, before the destruction of Jerusalem. Fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Some of the Jews say it was Bar Kokhba, which came shortly before that time, but we'll save that for another study. Anyway, the lawgiver from between his feet till Shiloh comes, the one to whom it belongs comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people, binding his donkey to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. I like the way they describe people. White teeth like milk. Zebulun, verse 13, shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall adjourn Sidon. And exactly what happened. He moved up into the Galilee region, and he took over what is today known as Lebanon and the port of Tyre and Sidon that have been bombed lately. That is where Zebulun settled in the north. Issachar is a strong donkey, laying down between two burdens. Now, at that time, it was an honorable thing to call someone who was a donkey. Now, today, it wouldn't be too honorable. You might get a black eye if you called someone that. But in those days, it was an honorable thing because it meant strength and perseverance. It also meant stubbornness. But nonetheless, he says, you're as strong as an ox, but you're lazy. And this seems to be the traits of this guy. He was very strong, but he became very lazy, and his descendants did too. He saw that the rest was good. He lay down to rest. And that the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden, and he became a band of slaves. He was the one that submitted as they went into the land, as you'll see later on, when they apportioned the land. This is one of the tribes that bowed to the Canaanite rule. They just sort of gave in and said, take us, we'll do anything you want. They became slaves. Verse 16, Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heel so that the rider fall backwards. In the book of Judges, they moved into the Hula Valley up north, up in northern Israel. And on the tour, when we go to the tour, you'll see where Dan settled up in the north. You'll see some of the altars that Dan set up. In between the Golan Heights and the mountains of Lebanon is this beautiful valley, the Hula Valley, and that's where they settled later. But he said that he's a viper by the path that bites the horse's heel, so that the rider falls backwards. Dan moved north, and it was under the reign of Jeroboam the king that idolatry through this tribe entered into Israel, as we just talked a little while ago. And then he says in verse 18, in the middle of all this, he says, I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. The word salvation is the Hebrew word Yeshua. I have waited for Yeshua, your salvation, O Lord. Yeshua is a Hebrew contraction for Yehoshua, which means Jehovah is salvation. Later it got changed to a smaller Yeshua. In the Old Testament we call him Joshua. Joshua and Yeshua is the same name. Jesus is the Greek word, but Yeshua is Jesus' Hebrew name. I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. Then he says, verse 19, Gad, a troop, Egads, a troop shall trump upon him, and he shall triumph at last. This is the tribe that was beaten by some of the desert Arabian tribes throughout its history. Bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Now, I don't know what happened to this tribe, but there's got to be a lot of them left in Israel, because there's still a lot of beautiful pastries and dainties when you go over there. The breads and the pastries, they've got some great stuff they make with honey, some of the halva and the hummus and the different foods that they have. Man, those guys know how to do it. They don't have good bagels, though, over there. Bagels came from New York. Verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful branch. A fruitful branch by a well. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, hated him. His bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of El Shaddai, the mighty God. For there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. The shepherd, Jesus Christ, the stone of Israel, came forth out of the lineage of Jacob through Judah. But he's inserted here in Joseph as a reference to Jacob, not Joseph. But the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. To the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Joseph had that ability as he was growing in the Lord, as we made reference to him this morning. He was constantly growing in his relationship with the Lord, so that he was called a fruitful branch in verse 22, and his branches went over the wall. And Joseph did just that. Benjamin, verse 27, is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. He was about the fiercest tribe of all of them. In fact, at one point, all of the other 11 tribes ganged up against him because he was waging a war, and they barely made it. He was a fierce guy, and he was quite a divisive person. It was King Saul came out of this tribe. Paul the Apostle came out of this tribe. Both kind of fighters in their own way. Verse 28, and all these are the 12 tribes of Israel. So he had quite a farewell speech. I missed verse 21. Naphtali is a deer let loose. He gives goodly words. Verse 29. Then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abram brought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. Verse 31. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife, and there they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife, and there I buried Leah. The field and the cave is there were purchased from the sons of Heth, and when Jacob had finished his commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. So he said, well, it's time for me to die. So he crawled in bed, put his feet up there, and that was it. He died. And he was gathered together with his people. And then the last chapter of Genesis. And Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. He loved him very much. And Joseph commanded his servants and the physicians to embalm his father so that the physicians embalmed Israel. The embalming processes of the Egyptians were incredible. We don't even know today how they preserved their bodies for so long. When I was in London one time, there's this place called the British Museum, which is my favorite place over there. And they have mummies over there. And one of the mummies they have preserved was it was the Pharaoh Ramses who told Moses to let the people go. The same Pharaoh, they have him preserved, and you can look at his features, his face, his hair is still intact. Thousands of years old, still today. The embalming was incredible. They put them in the coffins and they wrapped them up, but whatever they used, it was incredible, still preserved today, intact. So as I looked at this guy in the museum in this casket, looking at his hair and his ears, I said, it's amazing for me to look upon the same face that Moses looked upon, still preserved after thousands of years. It was just, it does something to you. If you went to Hebron today, and on the tour to Israel, we stop in Hebron at the caves of Machpelah. You can't go in the caves. There's a shrine that Herod the Great built over them. But if you could go in there, and you could get into the caves, you wouldn't find Abraham. He'd be decayed. Isaac. But you would find Jacob, probably. Very well preserved. You'd also probably find Joseph, because he was carried into Egypt also. Still preserved to this day. You'd probably find an Egyptian casket, because he was taken up into Hebron and buried there. Probably still very well intact, because they've dug up some of the Egyptian mummies, and the way they have preserved them is incredible, if you're into going into tombs. And so it says in verse 3, 40 days were required for him. They spent that long of time embalming him. For such are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Quite a funeral. And when the days of his mourning were passed, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you will bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father, and as he made you swear. So Joseph went to bury his father with him. Went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of the house, and the elders of the land of Egypt. Great procession up into Canaan. As well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers. What's interesting, they had to go up to Canaan. This is the same route, basically, that Moses had to take. It took Moses 40 years, because he went around in circles all those times, as you'll see later on. But him, he just went right up and back, up into the land of Canaan. And then verse 9, and there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was very great gathering. They came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a very great and solemn lamentation. And he observed 7 days of mourning for his father. And when the inhabitants of the land of the Canaanites saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning of the Egyptians. Therefore its name was called Abel Mizraim, which means mourning of Egypt. And his sons did for him just as he had commanded, for the sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham brought from the field from Ephron the Hittite as a property for the burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went with him to bury his father. It would seem that that's quite a burden to put on the family, to make them carry him hundreds of miles to the north to be buried in his favorite little place. They couldn't fly him there. But Jacob figured it probably that God had given him the inheritance to the land of Israel. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so Jacob figured, God promised me this land, I want to be buried there. So the family acquiesced, they agreed to it, they went along with it, they buried him up there in the caves of Machpelah. But God hasn't promised me a land. So if the Lord takes me, if I kick, you don't have to carry me anywhere. I don't have to be buried in Huntington Beach or any sentimental place. I think that as a Christian now, it really doesn't matter. And don't forget that when a person dies, don't identify that person with the house that he just left. Because when he vacates his body, he's gone into a different... This body is not me, and the bodies that you have are not you. They're just houses for you to express yourself. But don't mistake the house and the tent for the person. For God has prepared a tent not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. That's what Abraham was looking for, it says in the book of Hebrews. So we should never confuse that. And I don't think it really matters really what you do with a person's body or how you bury it or what you do after death. People say, well, what about cremation? Personally, I don't see any problem with cremation. I think all you're doing in cremation is speeding up nature's processes. Because they can do in 37 minutes what it takes nature to do in 37, 40 years. You're just speeding up nature a little bit. The outcome's the same. The body is just the body. It's going to decay. So spiritually, scripturally, I don't see any problem with it. When I go, I don't care what they do with my body. I'm not going to be around to worry about it. I'm going to be enjoying my new body with the Lord. You can do anything you want with it. But being in heaven with the Lord in a new body, that's where it's at. Verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us. Here we go again. And may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. So they sent messengers to Joseph. They wouldn't even talk to him. Saying, before your father died, he commanded, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg, and I think they probably made this up. You shall say to Joseph, because Jacob knew that he forgave him, I beg you, please, forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sins, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of God, call them the servants of God, of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. See, Joseph had forgotten about it. They were still under this guilt complex. He had forgiven them and he had forgotten. Now you say, is it possible to forget? I'm not talking about washing your memory away. To forget biblically means to not keep an account of wrong. It means every time somebody does something wrong, you don't write it down. Well, I remember 10 years ago, this is what you did. And we must learn to forgive and to forget. Not to hold something against someone. Well, honey, you remember what you did to me 3 weeks ago? Huh. Forget it. Don't keep an account of wrongs. One of the translations for 1 Corinthians is love doesn't keep an account of wrongs. For he forgot about it, but they were still under this guilt thing. But it says Joseph wept when they spoke to him. It must have been hard to be misunderstood for years and years. Nobody understands you. He wept when they spoke to him, and his brothers also went and fell down before his face and said, behold, we are your servants. And Joseph said, one of the most fantastic two verses in the Bible, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for me, you meant evil against me. What you guys did, brothers, was evil. It was wrong. No getting around that. You meant it for evil. But God meant it for good, in order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive. Hey, I was an instrument of God. Oh, if we could view hardships more that way. The sovereignty of God in our lives. He says, am I in the place of God? Next time you're bitter against someone and you want to get him back and you're vengeful, remember, are you in the place of God? Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. And any time you do something for the Lord, at least in public view, expect critics. There's always critics. But if you spend your time chasing critics, you will waste your whole ministry and your whole life trying to chase down tales about you. I don't have to defend myself. God is my lawyer. He's my advocate. I don't have to defend the Lord. And I don't care what people say when you're serving the Lord in the critics' view. That's unimportant. What I care about, what we should care about, is God saying, well done, thou good and faithful servant. You've done what I wanted you to do. The fear of man can be a great hindrance to the work for the Lord. worrying about what people are going to say or do. You should be worrying about what God would think and what God would say. Am I in the place of God, he said. And then verse 21, now therefore do not be afraid. I will provide for you and for your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. What a life. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt. He and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to their third generation, so he became a great-grandfather. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, who was also brought up on Joseph's knees, and Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So he wanted the same thing. He wanted to be buried with his dad. But at least he gave him some time. Just bury my bones with me. You can wait a few years. So Joseph died being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. It seemed that the Jewish people have a love for their land, always to go back to their land. When you go to Israel today, the whole Mount of Olives is filled with Jewish cemeteries. Because Jews from all over the world say, I want to be buried in Jerusalem. And you'll see the ultra-Orthodox Jewish cemetery there on the Mount of Olives and surrounding Jerusalem, as it's been their love for the land. I've never seen a people love the land as much as the Israelis. And the Hebrews, it just didn't start in 1948 or Adolf Hitler or World War II. It is all the way back from Jacob, Joseph, Abraham. They all wanted to be in the land, the love for the land, something that God has put in them. So we finished the book of Genesis.